Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, insert random sponsor here, is proud to bring to you its international podcasting champions of the world, Precious Pat Henson, Big Sexy Scott Morris, the main event, Meeples! Welcome back, everybody. We are here with episode 3 of Main Event Meeples. I am one of your two hosts, Big Sexy Scott Morris. I am here with Precious Pat Henson. Pat, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. I hope everybody's finding themselves having a good time. I am certainly enjoying myself. I just watched Rampage of Dynamite from the weekend. I have a lot of thoughts, and I'm ready to talk about this stuff. I really have, I don't know, we'll talk about it more, but good stuff. That and that Wardlow segment.
It's pretty good, wasn't it?
and Wardlow, if you're listening, we love you.
Yeah, man. Thanks for the comments and the follow. I really appreciate that. That's pretty awesome. I would like to try and bat 1,000 so that every time I say someone is going to become the world heavyweight champion that they follow us. Like that would be great. But I mean, we'll sooner or later run out of things at that point. But
no, that's totally true.
I'm glad you're doing well. I watched Dynamite and Rampage, and just as like a timestamp for everybody, we're recording this on the 25th of October, just slightly after the last Saturday AEW Dynamite. And I tell you, I'm actually kind of glad it's going back to Wednesdays. The whole Friday and Saturday thing back to back is cool. And in some ways, I've kind of felt like this, you know, Saturday Night Dynamite kind of reminds me of Saturday Night's Main Event as a kid and, you know, watching the Mega Powers and all that fun stuff. But it's just kind of, it's too overlapped, I feel. Like, we had our discussion last week about is there too much AEW TV, but I think that it's a nice break to have Wednesday and Friday, right?
Yeah, I what I found is that the pacing of it, like I would usually watch Dynamite on tape delay the next day or Friday, and then would watch Rampage over the weekend and write it up for my blog, rabscuttle.medium.com, and it would be a nice paced thing. And then the weekends where we had a pay-per-view, that was always something special, right? And it felt different. These last 2 weeks have felt like, okay, I got to cram all this in, you know, before Scott and I talk on Monday or Tuesday, and it's not as enjoyable. When it was the NBA finals and those shows were, you could tell everyone involved was kind of mailing it in. It kind of didn't matter. These last 2 weeks, however, have been pretty awesome in terms of they're not like the July, August range of Dynamites that we saw, but they've been very good. And from an in-ring perspective, they've been outstanding.
They have.
That's just the Danielson Fish match. The Suzuki Danielson match was outstanding this week. I really thought Pac and Andrade have absolute fight forever magic chemistry.
They were made for each other. I mean, literally, like, I feel bad for Charlotte because I don't know if he loves her anymore because, I mean, they're phenomenal. I mean, two of them could go. I texted you and I said that, you know, this could be a best of seven. I mean, it could be a best of 700. I could watch those two go at it. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of watching Bret Hart as the Hart Foundation with him and Jim Neidhart against the British Bulldogs.
Yeah.
Because Bret and Dynamite had such good chemistry together. And it was like, you didn't know what was going to happen or when it was going to happen. And it wasn't just two guys hitting their moves. It was guys telling a story and doing unbelievable, amazing things. So, yeah.
The thing about it, you knew that match was going in the first 10 seconds when Pac hits one of the nastiest looking German suplexes I've seen in a long time. And it's just, it was off to the races from that point. And the whole match was Pac is going to keep putting out big move after big move to keep Andrade off his feet until, you know, he eventually can do enough to win. And, you know, he got it. And that was great with an Avalanche. Oh my God, that Avalanche Brainbuster was awesome.
Yeah, I think Dax Harwood in the back was kind of jumping up and down when that happened.
I imagine he was. He was like, "That's mine," you know, going all Undertaker, like no one can choke slam anyone but me.
I think we could have an entire show about who does the better German suplex, the Snapdragon from Kenny Omega or the Whip Dragon from Pac, because that, man, that bounce off the ropes into the Snapdragon is just brutal. But at the same time, every time Kenny Omega does the Snapdragon suplex, I don't care if it's somebody the size of Hangman Page or the size of Fuego del Sol, I feel the guy's dead. Like every time.
and when he does multiple ones, like when he would have to do it against Okada, when he would have to do him against Okada, he looked like he killed him every time he did it. And Okada just would like somehow stagger up like a drunken man. And it led to amazing greatness. And this has been a fun opener to a degree of two commentators. Yeah. We haven't even gotten into the podcast properly yet. We're just enjoying ourselves because it's been like as grueling as kind of the schedule has been set up, it's been good shows.
Yeah, it has. So speaking of getting to the podcast, and speaking of guilty pleasures and enjoying things and things like that, I got a question for you, because we said we were going to ask each other questions at the beginning of the show to kind of introduce ourselves to people. So, you know, this whole weekend, I honestly, seriously feel I am the only person on God's green earth that did not watch Dune, because everybody...
Oh, no, I didn't either.
Okay, good. Thank goodness, right? I'm like...
I don't want to. I really want to watch it. I haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, I do too. I didn't get a chance to watch it yet. And there was a lot of people. I mean, everybody and their brother was over social media talking about the movie and everything. And it got me thinking, because I have a lot of guilty pleasure movies that... And I wouldn't consider Dune a guilty pleasure movie, the new one, by any means whatsoever. The original one, though, is not really that great of a film. I'll just leave it at that. So it could be a cult, you know, guilty pleasure movie. I honestly, and this may revoke my nerd card a little bit or my geek card a little bit, and I'm okay with it, I have never seen the original Dune movie all the way through in one sitting. I have watched it and I have seen the whole movie, but because it's so long and because I would always find it like interspersed on TV and stuff, I never went to see it in the theaters when I was a kid, because I just didn't really have an interest in it. And then when it did come to TV, I only caught like an hour and 10 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes. And then I'd have to go do something. And then I'd come back and watch it again, because back in the day, things like that were on TNT like every 3 days. So it was crazy. But I want to know, what is your guilty pleasure movie? What is one of the things that when you're having a bad day, or when you just, you know, just need to chill and relax and just turn off all the thinking cells, like what is your guilty pleasure movie to go to?
So I have like a list depending on what happened that day and what kind of cheering up that I need. Like if I really am having a sad, like I just need to feel better about the world, the 50th anniversary episode of Doctor Who is like a go-to feel good thing for me, but absolute popcorn guilty pleasure that is irredeemable in my fandom. And it's totally because as a person diagnosed with ADD, I recognize that the reason I love this movie is all the flashy, fast moving stuff. I could watch Gone in 60 seconds. Just you put that on, I'm going to stare at it the whole time.
Sir Nicholas Cage gone in 60 seconds.
Man, I have an Eleanor sitting on my desk. I have an Eleanor.
Nice.
From one of the box companies that sent him out. But yeah, there's something about that movie that I just really enjoy. The cars, the fun, the everything. And I have friends of mine that love Fast and Furious, and I'm just like, nah, man. OG, You gotta love Gone in 60 Seconds. It's Michael Bay at his most self-indulgent and silly. And
wait a minute, like, Michael Bay is not self-indulgent?
I don't know. Actually, not self-indulgent. It's like he's not. He dials it back a little, and I don't know. It's
a good movie.
Lot of really pretty cars, and there's lots of good. That chase sequence at the end is great.
And it's just as absurd and over the top as Fast and the Furious is, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Fast and the Furious going into space.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last one kind of put the dent in that argument. But yeah, that the other list is like Clue the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I can go to sleep
favorite
that
of
movie.
Mine. It's a favorite of mine.
The Hudsucker Proxy.
Ah, the Hula Hoop.
The Hula Hoop. You know, for kids.
That's right.
Coen Brothers, as produced by Joel Silver, with Sam Raimi directing.
Some of those are really good movies, though. I mean, they're not movies like that I would consider, like, you know, someone might thumb their nose up. I mean, maybe Gone in 60 Seconds, just because.
Yeah, that's
you know,
the
one. You gotta kind of like it or not like it, right?
But yeah.
I know a lot of people that love the Coen Brothers. I mean, between, you know, Lady Killers and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I mean, even most recently, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, right? I mean, they have a very unique style and a very, you know, very interesting storytelling ways about them.
Yeah. And I took your question of like, what's your guilty pleasure and what's going to make you feel better? And kind of was like, well, here are the things that I'm going to enjoy and feel better while I'm watching them. I'm trying to think of this is a terrible film. Oh, I know. I know now. It's a movie called Mean Guns.
Mean Guns.
I warn you that if you seek this out, I did tell you ahead of time, it's really bad. It stars Christopher Lambert, Ice-T, and a bunch of other people. And the premise of the movie, and this was 15 years ago, 20. Actually, it's old enough that it doesn't have a full widescreen release.
Oh, wow.
Like on DVD. It's a 4x3 movie.
Straight to VHS.
No, it was, well, I don't know. I caught it on HBO one night and was like, this is so terrible, yet transfixing.
Okay, so I just looked it up as we're sitting here talking on IMDb, and I have to read this description,
right,
so that people can understand what you're talking about here. Because first off, the poster, I can't tell if it's a vampire movie or if it's like a gangster movie, because it's like, yeah, it's got Ice-T, but he's got this cross on. And then, I don't know, Christopher Lambert looks like he's kind of a depressed Duncan MacLeod. It's like, I don't really know what's going on.
That's not too far from the character he plays, you know.
It says it's an action crime thriller. And it was actually made in 1997. It is 1 hour and 44 minutes of your life, and it is rated R, so don't let kids watch it without supervision.
Oh, definitely not.
It says 100 people who have betrayed the syndicate are gathered in a prison opening the next day. They are given weapons and 6 hours to kill each other. The three remaining will share $10 million.
Go.
So I have so many questions from this.
With like the worst production values. It's so
so wait a minute. So
terrible.
They're given weapons and 6 hours to kill each other. What happens if there's not three people remaining at 6 hours? What if there's nine people remaining?
Hush, child.
Well, why is it three? Why can't it be two? Why can't I wipe out everybody and take the 10 million myself?
Well, as two people in the film actually talk through, they're self-aware enough to be like, well, what happens if there's only two? He wasn't that specific. Like,
that's pretty
funny. It's actually a great thing. But the part, the piece, there's two pieces that go to this. There's three, actually. One, they love the like sword coming out of the shaft, like shing, like that sound effect way too much, and it's used constantly. Also, the lighting in this is, let me put it this way. When people were complaining about the first Star Trek and all the lens flare, I was like, well, it's not that bad. Like the lighting in this is awful. It's unbelievably bad. And the third thing, the entire thing is set to, Mambo music.
Oh my
God.
The whole
movie is set to like this Simba Mambo beat.
Mambo number five.
Yeah, but it's not. It's like classic good like 50s Mambo.
I'm looking at the cast now, and it says that Christopher Lambert plays Lou.
Yeah.
Lou doesn't have a last name. It just says Lou.
Just Lou.
I don't know who in casting sits down and says, yeah, Lambert looks like a Lou. But then I looked at Ice-T's name. Now, I have mad respect for Ice-T. I love Ice-T from back in the day. And I remember just he was so controversial and he was so different and he was so cool. And still to this day, like, there's people I don't want to be in a room with alone. And Ice-T's probably on the top of that list. Sam Elliott's on the top of that list too, I think. But I mean, Ice-T is a bad MF-er, right?
Yeah, no, he's seen some stuff.
And according to this, it says Ice-T plays, and I quote, Vincent Moon.
Yeah, he's Moon. He's the representative of the syndicate who put this all together.
Ah,
and so he's okay. He's like the game master. And remember, this is before Battle Royale. Also, it's pre-Matrix, which is...
It is. Matrix was 99. Yeah.
And it looks like it's like the baby version of, hey, we're going to take all this Hong Kong Kung Fu stuff and have no budget and no production value and way too many lights and just see what we can do. And it's magical in a car crash full of baby seals kind of way. It's delightful in its terribleness. And there's like a complex plot to it and everything that's convoluted. It's
okay. Of course there is. I mean, a bad guilty movie or a good guilty movie wouldn't be simple, right? It's gotta be complex.
All right. I saw a post from you and immediately, like, I scrolled past because you said AEW spoilers and was like, oh no.
I'm cool like that. I don't ruin it for people.
And we didn't put 900 spaces between it. So I caught the first paragraph. And it was like, that was the worst ending.
We're talking about Malakai Black versus Cody Rhodes 3.
Malakai Black versus Cody Rhodes 3, where the crowd gives Cody and AEW a gift. They hand them on a silver platter a gift. My question is, as I was ruminating about it and knowing you, when did you start hating good guys?
That's a good question. I don't think I hate good guys.
And by the way, this is a man who has like a Captain America shield above his desk. Like,
I do.
You know, one of his dogs is named
Captain America.
Captain America.
I don't hate good guys. I mean, I think, wow. I didn't like the ending at all. I didn't like the ending of Rampage because I felt that they needed to make it about the Cody Malakai Black match the following night on Saturday than the actual epic that, like we talked about at the beginning of the match, that Pac and Andrade put on. I thought that kind of took away from them.
Yeah, that's what they chose to do. I didn't like that. But
yeah, I didn't like that. And I'll say this. My angst for the ending has been somewhat swayed by social media posts of Malakai Black saying things that, you know, it does not matter if I won or lost. What matters is you've changed and you're different now. And I agree, you know, there is a bit of the story moving on from there, which is really good. But I think that the casual viewer may not see that. And the casual viewer is who AEW needs for the ratings. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of people say this, the money's in the chase. And I've always been a fan of the bad guy being champion and the good guy chasing them. It's very hard to be a face and be champion. I mean, if you look back at what Moxley did the year he was champion, it's pretty darn amazing.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to be a long-term face champion and not become stale and not become just kind of, you know, okay, kind of, yeah, it's good. Let's get on, right? You know, move on to something else. Mm-hmm. I've thought a lot about this, and we could actually make an entire show about this. I will challenge our listeners, and you, if you'd want to jump in on this. Name me five heels. I know people switch face, heel, face, all that stuff. But name me five people who are predominantly known as heels who died young for whatever reason, accidents or, you know, health reasons or whatever it may be. But I would tell you this, because I have done research on this. It's really hard to find five. I mean, you always hear about wrestlers dying young. You always hear about people having tragic things happen to them. It's predominantly the good guys. And I've started to come to this theory that the bad guys don't have as much stress in their personal lives because they don't have to perform to anyone's expectations. They're the bad guys, right? If you go back to even the heydays of like Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy, right? Like Hulk Hogan had to be the American hero all the time. I just saw an article this week that was an interview with Jacques Rougeau, the Mountie, and or from the Rougeau brothers, as I like to call them. And he was talking about how Hulk Hogan had issues with the Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldogs, because they would drink so much and they were supposed to be the good guys, right? They shouldn't be seen walking out of bars at 3 a.m. when they're, you know, stumbling out and everything like that. So the good guys have a bit of a, almost like a moniker of you've got to be a good guy all the time. Whereas
well, they had one.
They did, yes.
And kayfabe was still a thing.
Well, and for the most part, I think it is, right? Like, I mean, look at Max, right? I mean, MJF, sure. In my opinion, you know, you always hear that term that Rocky Johnson threw around that Dwayne Johnson uses, which is live the gimmick. And I mean, MJF, he is the gimmick. He is himself all the time. I've seen him at shows where 10-year-olds come up to get their picture with him and he flips them off. And, you know, he's just constantly berating people when they come up to ask him for autographs and everything. And he's just always on 100%. But I think that there comes a sense of freedom almost with being that level of a heel where you're like, I don't have to live up to anyone's expectations. Because if I flip off this 10-year-old, of course I'm a bad guy. Like, that's the way it's going to be, right? So I think for me, and I think you know me very well, I like to do things my own way. I don't like to do things by the book always or what should be done. I like to challenge the status quo. So I do kind of root a little bit more for the bad guys, I think, because they make it more interesting. So I don't hate the good guys. I mean, hey, one of my all-time favorite wrestlers of all time is Ricky Steamboat, who I don't think was ever a heel in his entire career.
I don't think he has a heel bone in his body.
I don't think he does either. Man's like, and he, I don't know if you've seen him lately. He looks like he could still go. I mean, he looks amazing.
I don't think he could go every night, but I bet you he could put on 10 minutes of fun.
Him and he's at that Sting level, right? He's 60 plus, but he's still got it. Right. So
talking about a guy that shouldn't be as good as he is, Stinger. Goodness.
Sting like is one of the dude. Biggest surprises. Biggest surprises. When I remember when he first took that first bump, and I think the entire wrestling community systematically all together went,
yeah, when he took like, that power bomb.
Yeah, and everyone was like, he's dead. Like Sting's dead. Brian Cage just killed him. What's going on? Right. And then like 3 days later, he's wrestling and everyone's like, this is amazing. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy. That's a whole nother topic probably we could do with Sting. So those are good questions. Those are good, definitely good questions. So we will continue to find things to ask each other to hopefully, you know, let you learn a little bit more about us and a little bit more about what we like and what we don't like. I definitely have Mean Guns on the list now, though. Ladies and gentlemen, in the opener, Scott will discuss which of the four pillars of AEW will win the AEW World Heavyweight Championship first, while Pat figures out what he's going to talk about. So since you got to think, I'll definitely kick off and get started here. My topic kind of follows on to MJF's interview recently where he said that there were four pillars of AEW, the guys that had been there since the beginning, who had kind of become the stars of AEW growing up inside the company and who he thinks are going to be the future. And those four people were Jungle Boy, Sammy Guevara, Darby Allin, and MJF, which ironically, at the current moment in time, as of you know, recording this right now, MJF is the only heel out of that group. And the other guys are faces. Sammy was a heel, but he's obviously a face right now at the Inner Circle. And I don't disagree with him by any means whatsoever. I think the four of them they're not necessarily, it's hard for me to look at them and say they're AEW bred when you look at the matches that like Darby Allin and Ethan Page have had outside of AEW in the indies, and you look at Max's MLW run. I mean, his run in MLW, I think, pretty much set him up to be the big bad douchebag that he is in AEW. Yeah,
it's where Cody figured out who he was.
Yeah, and I mean, Sammy, I mean, I knew enough about Sammy because you live in Austin. I used to live in Austin. The guy wrestles mm-hmm. in all different areas in San Antonio and Houston and everything like that. If you were into the local wrestling scene, you knew who Sammy was. But Sammy went from like wrestling in a crowd of 23 people to being the first match ever on Dynamite with yeah. Cody Rhodes. Yeah. And we talked a little bit, you know, about Wardlow and Cody Rhodes and Wardlow's pressure that he had on him. Man, can you imagine the pressure on Sammy Guevara that night? Hey, kid, this is going to be live on TV. It's the first time wrestling's been on TBS in like 20 years. And you got to go against the guy that pretty much created the company. I mean,
good luck trying not to die.
And in the back of his head, he had to remember that he had to get through the whole night because they had the Inner Circle formation at the end of the show. So the pressure for that must have been absolutely crazy. But all four of these guys have proven it, right? And like you mentioned a couple of, I think two episodes ago, in episode one, about how Jungle Boy may not, you know, be the best on the mic and things like that. These guys all are learning, right? Even Max is learning. I mean, a lot of people want to put Max as like, he's the greatest heel in wrestling. And he is very, very good right now. But I mean, to say he's the best ever, I mean, guy's 25. He's still got 20, maybe 30 years left in him to do amazing things. And I said it once, and I do believe this. I don't think Max ever needs to be world champion. I think MJF could easily be the Rowdy Roddy Piper of AEW. I think he could be the guy that is a constant thorn in the face's side. He's the guy who will get his comeuppance at times, and then he'll also be the one getting comeuppance at times. And he will always be able to be that main event superstar that is always considered a threat, whether or not he has the belt. And I think that's a really important distinction for MJF. The other guys, I think, you know, the belts definitely elevate them. I mean, obviously, Sammy is the TNT champion right now, which is a great thing. Darby was TNT champion as well. Jungle Boy has not been TNT champion, which I'm really kind of surprised at, actually. I mean, Jungle Boy has a lot of really, really good in-ring skills. The thing that worries me about Jungle Boy is his ability to talk, because it's ironic given his dad, right? I mean, his dad's Luke Perry, one of the most famous actors of the 90s, you know, on every Teen Beat cover you could ever find. And, you know, his dad was very supportive of his wrestling and would go to his shows and everything when he was still alive, which I think is awesome. But I think that is a limiting factor for Jungle Boy. I think Jungle Boy is great in the ring. I think he's always going to be great in the ring as long as he's healthy. But I think that unless he can learn to break away from Jurassic Express, and I pardon this pun, it's bad, but until Jungle Boy becomes Jungle Man, I don't know if he's ever going to be world championship material. Maybe TNT material, maybe tag team champion material, but I don't know if he'll become the number one guy.
I think that the feud that's going to make him, he's already part of.
Adam Cole.
Yeah. I think Adam Cole is going to teach him mountains of things, of how to be a true star. Because what I saw on Dynamite was Jungle Boy come out with the passion that I wanted him to have for ages when he gave a promo. He's not perfect by any means, but when he lets loose, and just like every other wrestler, man, when you tap into that intensity and the things that you believe in, that integrity to yourself, suddenly you take promos to another level. When he came out and just railed, that was a great segment. And then Cole and the Bucks were perfect in their characters, putting him down. And I just wrote it, but I think when Jungle Boy gets that win, that's going to be amazing.
I think it will too, but I don't think he's going to be the first to become AEW.
No, I don't think so either. I think he is going to be perpetually.
He's the chaser.
He's the chaser. He absolutely is. The thing is, when you talk about the Heat, I see, that's weird, because I would imagine that you would have thought Max doesn't need the belt to be great, but Max is, to me, more than Rowdy Roddy Piper. He's Flair.
I think he is ready. I think he was ready when he fought Moxley. I just don't think it's the right time.
Sure. I think Max is Ric Flair. Because
for sure.
He is the modern day. And I think when he gets a hold of that title, he is going to hold on to it forever.
I think he could easily become, when he wins the belt, the longest reigning champion when he does get it. Because he would be the guy that would cheat and find a way to get out of it. And everyone would just love to hate him. Almost very much like the Bucks with the tag team championships. I mean, there was a point where people were going nuts for the Varsity Blondes to defeat the Bucks because they just wanted anybody to beat the Bucks. It was like they were so good at being a heel. Now, ironically, I think Darby Allin is in a little bit of the same situation, meaning that Darby is the underdog, the perpetual underdog. And in ways, I look at Darby Allin and I feel like he is kind of like this strange amalgamation of part Sting and part Jeff Hardy, right?
Yeah.
He's a daredevil. He'll do anything to win matches, but he's cerebral at the same time, like Sting was. And that's not a bad thing by any means whatsoever. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. But he's also kind of put himself in that position where he doesn't need a belt. You know, when he got absolutely destroyed by Miro, that just made him look better. Like it was so fitting to Darby's character. And I think when you look at the four of these guys, I think it's Sammy Guevara. I think out of all four of them, Sammy is going to be the one to become the champion first, because they've already kind of laid out this MJF and Sammy don't like each other. And, you know, Jericho's getting older and the Inner Circle is going to need someone to step up and be the leader. So I could easily see a world a couple of years down the road here, maybe not too far down the road, where Sammy becomes world champion. And that's the person that drops it to MJF. And then that's where things kick in and get going.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Sammy is outstanding. That promo he cut this week was great with Lambert and everything. I mean, the guy understands how to pop a crowd in all the good ways. He's kind of grown out of the shadow. His vlog is a wonderful storytelling device. And when he turns on Fuego del Sol, it'll be great. You know, the heat he'll generate off that will be amazing. But yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else I would say to that. But no, I think MJF's going to hold it for a really long time. I think he's going to be a lifer in AEW, because he would be watered down to the point of not himself. Like that Lex Luger line. Oh man. Woo. And he just keeps going with those lines that are beyond the pale, and he delivers them in exactly the right way, where he pushes it just right. And I think that's great. I think that Darby is a made man at this point. Yes. His title run minted him, and then those, ironically, those house show matches that were on TV where he got the rub from Moxley and Kingston.
Yep.
The thing about AEW though is that those four guys are the cream of that crop. Cream of the crop. But you know, just below that you've got Ricky Starks, who I have the pleasure of saying I saw his last indie match before he went to Pro Wrestling Noah.
Nice.
In Austin. You have whatever they decide, like Orange Cassidy is perpetually just waiting in the wings to be plugged in. You have, who else you got? You've got a ton of guys that are under 30 that are all really good at what they do, and they can continue to be just absolutely fun to watch in the ring. I think Max Caster and Anthony Bowens have a lot of possibilities. I think that.
Are you saying you don't see Brandon Cutler challenging for the AEW world title in the future?
Okay, let's talk about this for a second. Brandon Cutler, and this might be my part of the opener. I'll just take this, my love for, okay, yeah, this is what I'm going to talk about. My love for guys who lean in.
Oh, like, yeah, he is definitely leaned in and very comfortably.
He was, you know, the king of all nerds with the dice bag thrown in the ring and the D4s and everything against.
Body, you know, slamming Peter Avalon onto, oh, yeah, D4s. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, that's that was gnarly. But he is just, he was a guy that never quite connected right and should have. He's got all the physical skills you need, but he couldn't make the crowd connect with him as a straight baby face. He has turned into, you know, against his will in kayfabe, the associate stooge, and he's fantastic. He's absolutely fantastic. Every time he grabs the mic and steals it and tries to overdo it, he's good. On BTE, he's entertaining because he's like, when the Bucks aren't around, he's like, I'm the big dog now, and anybody challenges him and he backs down. Like, he's great. And it leads to wrestlers who lean into their character that make the show better. And that you see guys and who are comedy guys who embrace it. I would argue that Daniel Bryan when he was Daniel Bryan, and Kane with Team Hell No was an example of, like, if you commit to this bit, there is genius here. We just
Our truth,
absolutely. He completely converted me from someone who was like, get him off my television, to, well, I don't watch you anymore, but good for you for figuring out the 24/7 champion.
I have loved R-Truth since day one. I mean, since he was Ron Killings, I remember looking at him and saying, this guy is just amazing. He's built like a god. I mean, the dude, even now, later in his career, dude is ripped beyond belief, and he's funny and he's topical and he's smart and he's quick, and I'm just like, yeah, I love everything about Ron Killings.
And he is the guy that Vince McMahon thinks is the funniest guy on the roster,
because he's willing to do whatever he's asked.
There's that, yeah, that's important. But the whole leaning in concept, like, there's a Henry Rollins bit, and for those of you who know who Henry Rollins is, you'll understand how weird it is to say that he talked about going to see Kiss. And Henry is old school punk. He was the lead singer of Black Flag. He's a guy from the 70s who grew up on the Ramones and the Clash, and his hardcore punk guy. Well, his bandmates are all huge Clash fans, right? And they get him to go to a Kiss show. Sorry, they're all big Kiss fans. They get him to go to a Kiss show, and he finds himself just rocking out, because what he's watching is these four guys on stage, all painted up in the makeup and everything, with the pyro a million miles in the air, and they're just rocking out. They're unironically having a great time rocking out. And suddenly he realizes that what they're doing, and the wisdom of it, is that, you know, how many bands has he seen where the guy's like, this is our single? You know, it's like, I liked your single, but now I don't care because I don't like you. How many guys have we seen that come out and they're handed a character and they just dead loaf it? They don't care. And they just,
and we're not talking as bad as like a Seven, but just lean into their character.
Don't lean into their character. Whereas then you hand guys like Paul White, you handed him the impersonation character. And suddenly he goes from being a generic guy who's huge to being really interesting, because you suddenly realize this guy's really funny. And if you use him correctly and allow his comedy to come out, he's not only a scary big man, but he can have some good stuff with it. When Mick Foley leans in to be sympathetic in that he's just himself and he's just a fan and he leans into the characters of it. But like, you've got guys all over the place that haven't figured that out yet. I would wager that some of the wisdom of Eddie Kingston is that you just got to go with it. You know, like, the guy leans in to his character. He leans into the performance he's giving, and that intensity comes through the screen. It leaps off the screen. Him and Moxley both, they leap off the screen in terms of believability and integrity. When Moxley gave that promo about, you know, I believe in my, you know, the pinky finger and his daughter, I firmly believed he's ready to kill everyone on the roster to go home. I don't doubt it one bit.
It's the theme that kind of overrides all of that. And I've never met Brandon Cutler. I have no idea. I just go from what I see online and see on his own social media and stuff like that. I think the overriding factor there is the people that are leaning into things and having success with them, there is a bit of who they are personally in their real life, right? Like if when I look at John Moxley, he strikes me as someone, and for people who don't know, John Moxley's real name is John Good. His middle initial is not B, but it's John and Renee, his wife, he strikes me as someone that would be like, you know what? I've had a great career in wrestling. I'm walking away. I don't need anybody in wrestling ever again. I've got my wife. I've got my daughter. I've got my family. I'm fine. Like, you know, there is a realism to John Moxley and to Eddie Kingston. Like Eddie Kingston, I grew up in New York. Everybody I know that grew up in New York knows an Eddie Kingston. Like he is the living embodiment of a New York. If somebody said to me, I know a professional wrestler from New York, the image of Eddie Kingston would be in the dictionary as the picture next to it. I mean, that's what it is.
That's the starting image.
And Brandon is a geek. He likes games. I've tried to reach out to him several times actually to try and get him games, but he hasn't replied. So if you're listening, Brandon, at Main Event Meeples. Yeah. But he strikes me as leaning into that because he is a bit of a fanboy and he is a bit of a, you know, a closet geek, maybe, so to speak, right? But he's definitely come into his own, which is really, really cool to see.
As much as we've talked about leaning in, I think it's time to move on to the undercard. On today's undercard, Humankind and how it made Scott forget how to play Civilization. And Pat asks the question, what does make great wrestling music?
Is this going to be like the Suzuki method where you say that what makes good wrestling music is that it's bad wrestling music?
No, not at all. But I am gonna bring up one that you don't like.
Okay. I like a lot of wrestling music. In fact, I know. I follow Mikey Ruckus. In fact, if you don't follow Mikey Ruckus, go follow Mikey Ruckus on Twitter right now. He is the AEW music director. Dude is awesome. You've seen him. If you watch AEW, you've seen him and you don't know you've seen him. He was the guy that helped do the rap for the Lucha Bros when they came to the ring at All In.
Okay.
All Out, excuse me. And which was an amazing entrance, like mega entrance. But Mikey Ruckus is one of the coolest people I follow on Twitter. One of the most talented people, because like if somebody said to me Adam Cole was debuting tomorrow and by the following week his song would be number one on iTunes, I would have laughed. Like I would have been there's no way, right? So follow Mikey Ruckus. He makes great music.
To me, there's a bunch of music that I'll listen to all the time and I'll hear like the first 15 seconds of it and I'll replay it over and over again. I'm like, man, this would be insane if it was the opening, if it was somebody coming in. A great example of that is Gold on the Ceiling by the Black Keys. Like, it's like falling into the music and then it hits a break point and it just goes. Like I could see awesomeness coming out of that. And you hear it as somebody coming in from the back to make a save or do whatever. The thing to me that makes great wrestling music isn't, you know, whether or not you and I listening at home like it. It isn't how AEW chooses to mic it. Because, frankly, in Jacksonville, we all thought their music was terrible. And a bunch of the music that was terrible in Jacksonville is actually pretty good because they didn't do a good job on TV of getting the music done. Really, what it comes down to is the music has to reflect the guy coming to the ring or girl coming to the ring. And it has to be something that makes the crowd get into it further and sells it further. It helps if you've got chantable stuff in there. But for me, some of the best stuff right now, honestly, on TV, it's not as good. I'll grant you that. But John Moxley's entrance to Wild Thing in at a live show is awesome because it is so sing-alongable, if that's a phrase. And he really, and this is an unpopular opinion, I don't know anybody else who likes it other than like me and JR, but it's the Wild Thing from that they switched to the one from Major League, where it's got that long guitar riff before it drops in. It, the crowd chanting Wild Thing along with it, and just Moxley's raw persona and raw charisma make that thing work so well because the crowd can scream along with him and he can pop to it and he can time with it is another thing. The timing of it's great. Adam Cole's intro is one of the best examples of how to time everything perfectly to where he can have that boom moment and then he can just do the Adam Cole bebe. Kaze Ni Narai is cool, but Kaze Ni Narai is all about this anticipation. This like, all right, is it coming? Is it? Oh, he's he's at the ring ropes. And then it goes silent, and that one line comes out, and the crowd pops to it. You have all these guys. Like Stone Cold's music was great, not because it was a great song. It's a bad song, like dun 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 dun. But it's the glass break, and those iconic moments are what make wrestling music work so well. Like how God, what was his name? The guy who wrote WWE music forever.
I don't even remember, but I know who you're talking about. I can see him like tomorrow.
It's because crazy. I thought about it now. How he's not in the Hall of Fame is just a disgrace.
Because like, there is no Hall of Fame. The WWE Hall of Fame is a joke.
Yeah, it's a storyline tool, but seriously, that guy made more wrestlers and put over more guys.
Oh yeah,
because he
imagine Hulk Hogan without Real American.
Oh yeah, it's not a thing.
Never would have made it as big, right?
No. And that music, it pops a crowd. It gets them into it. It gets them hyped for the moment that's coming. When you had Ultimate Warrior, that music was a million miles an hour and you knew what was coming. Yeah. Yep. And like Batista coming out to I Walk Alone. By the way, if you have a chance, Google Xavier Woods at WrestleMania backstage.
Yes.
Watching Batista's entrance.
Yeah, it's marking out.
It's marking out like crazy. It's so great. It's so great. But the thing about Wild Thing and the thing about, Best Friends, the thing about what I love about Daniel Bryan's entrance music, where it's that Flight of the Valkyries into a great beat that apparently you can chop up, and I heard a crowd doing it, where the whole crowd was just chanting dragon, dragon, dragon. And it's a two syllable beat drop where if they just go, yes, 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 it's a little too fast. And I don't think that was intentional or anything, but it works out, you know, because he wants them to chant. He wants them to be more about the American Dragon than he is the Yes Man. And that music's great. Adam Cole's is phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. The one guy whose music I've never liked was Kenny Omega. It fits him because it's awkward, and it's anime music, you know, and it's cool, but it doesn't really do anything for me. But I'm telling you, man, that the thing that makes great wrestling music is to pop that live crowd and the glass breaking. If you smell what the Rock is, do you smell what the Rock is cooking? Things like that really, really drive home and make a guy and can take a guy who isn't ready to be great and become great as a result.
Yeah, I mean, the music is a giant important factor. When you heard the glass break, when you heard the first riff of I Am an American or I Am a Great American or whatever the name of the song was with Hulk Hogan, when you smell what the Rock is cooking, like when you and even now when Adam Cole's music hits, the very first thing you hear is, you know, it's all about the boom. And it's like, it's done in a very Rage Against the Machine-esque way that makes things recognizable and immediately. I mean, to me, ironically, I think the most recognizable sound in wrestling isn't even music. It's just a sound. And it's the Undertaker's bell.
Yeah.
The minute. Absolutely. It doesn't matter what federation you're in at this point. You could be in the middle of the G1 climax, and if that bell goes off, everybody knows what's about to happen, right? And as a kid growing up, I always remember Hot Street USA, Michael Hayes, and the Freebirds coming out to that terrible music. I hated it, but I always remember it, right? What would be if you were that alien from an Andromeda galaxy who was thrown in on day one, booping people in the nose? What, maybe not that angle, what would your entrance music be? Like if you were on the AEW roster and Tony Khan could go buy the rights to any music, what would your entrance music be? Would you have something original, or would you use something that is out there?
I want to see somebody use Golden on the Ceiling. Okay. I think it'd be great. If you go listen to the opening of that and just break it down and think about a wrestling show as you're listening to it, that'd be great. Muse has done a ton of stuff and has a certain sound to what they do when they bring those anthems. If you're going to have a more punk thing, a My Chemical Romance sound to it. Okay. They don't have one that's specifically that would work, but maybe Vampire Money from them. But it also comes back to, I don't know, because I don't know what character I'd be bringing to the ring.
I've always pictured myself that if I ever did become a manager, I've never wanted to be a wrestler, but I always wanted to be a manager. But if I ever did, like, you know, make it as a star, my music would be No Shelter by Rage Against the Machine. I think that would work really, really well. We've talked about nothing but wrestling this whole time.
Yeah.
And we are called the Main Event Meeples, not just about wrestling. We have other things we need to talk about. And I'm going to jump into the video game world, which is kind of board gamey at the same time. I'm a huge, huge fan of Civilization/4X games. The most notable game, of course, is Sid Meier's Civilization, which I have logged thousands, literally thousands of hours playing. In fact, Civ 6, I have played well over 1,000 hours on my Steam account, and I absolutely love it.
And Gandhi has nuked you every time.
Gandhi loves nukes. I don't get it, but he does love nukes in that game.
Oh, you don't know why?
Oh, no, I know why. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a bug in the first game. Anyway,
yeah,
keep going.
I love the long game of building a foundation, growing that foundation into something bigger, making your civilization bigger. And when Humankind was announced, it's designed by a development studio that I absolutely love. It's called Amplitude Studios. And I love all of their games. They make Endless Legend. They make Endless Space. They have this really cool kind of platformy game called Endless Dungeon. But Endless Space, Endless Space 2, and Endless Legend are very big grand strategy 4X games and are really, really good. And the thing that I always kind of brought me back to them was there was this slight narrative. Like, you can play Civilization and you can be whoever. You could be, you know, Gandhi. You could be, you know, Rome and Trajan or anything like that. And there's really no story to it. And it always kind of frustrated me that you were like, if I chose Trajan and I started off as Rome in like whatever, like 2000 BC, I'm still Trajan and I'm still Rome in like 10,000 AD, right? Like I didn't like that kind of unrealistic progression of things. And
you're playing a game where three guys represent an army, dude.
Yeah, I know. It's just, we're talking about subjective things that I like and I don't like. With Endless Legend and with Endless Space, there were these small narratives that were brought into the game. They weren't anything to write home about. They weren't like, oh man, this character connects with me so deeply or anything. But they were enough to make you feel for your faction and for your your group, and that was enough for me to get really hooked on them, and I really, really enjoyed them. Plus the species that are in these games are so non-traditional video game stuff. I absolutely love that. So Humankind gets announced a couple of years ago, and a lot of people joke that it was like, oh, it's Civ 7, right? Like looks like Civ, it acts like Civ, it breathes like Civ, it must be Civ. And it's not. Like, it is, apart from being on a hexagon map and going through the ages, there really is no comparison to the two games. They're very, very different games. but they are both 4X games. The thing that I have really loved about Humankind, and since it dropped in August, I've played nothing but Humankind.
Wow.
It is this unique thing where you aren't a leader, you are a culture. So you start as a Neolithic tribe, you go through and explore the world, settle down your first kind of outpost and your beginning cities, and you get to a certain point where you adopt a culture. So you can be the Egyptians, or you could be the Harappans, or you could be the Byzantines, and they all have different things that will help you, you know, get different things in the game. Some are scientifically focused, some are focused on industry and gold and things like that. But the really interesting thing is that you will come to another point in the game where you can adapt your culture. So you've adopted a culture at the beginning of the game, and now you can adapt your culture. And you keep part of your original culture. Every culture has like a ability, then a special building, and a special unit. But the ability will stay with you. And if you build the buildings or you build the units, they will stay with you. So if I start the game as the Egyptians and I build like the Egyptian pyramids, they will stay with me and continue to give me benefits even as I go into the modern age, which is a really cool thing. But the game becomes this thing where instead of playing one leader from beginning to end, you get to combo different cultures throughout the game to make this one mega civilization. And the game is partly about the 4X piece, but it's also partly about finding the really amazing combinations you can do flipping from, like, you know, the Celts to the Phoenicians or something like that. And like how you're going to jump from, you know, culture to culture and how it's going to benefit you in certain situations. And like I said, since it came out in August, I've played nothing but this game on my PC. I absolutely love it. And the other day I made the stupid mistake of booting up Civilization on my Switch. this is how
much. Oh my God, you played Civ on the Switch?
Yeah, this is how much of a Civ fan I am. Wow. I have bought everything for Civilization VI on my PC, on the Switch, on the Xbox, and on my mobile devices. So I've bought Civilization VI 4 different times, which is kind of crazy. And I love it. I just love the game. I booted it up for the first time, and it's only been maybe, you know what, 3 months, right? August, like middle of August is when Humankind came out. So September, October, we're 2 months in. I was so lost. Like I'm looking at things and I'm like, wait a minute, what was my move at this point? What did I do? How would I start this off? And what's my build order? Where would I go with this? It was such a drastic change. And it's funny because I never felt like Humankind changed things. I never felt like it was so different that I would feel, you know, like I was in a foreign land, pardon the pun, when I went back to Civilization, but it did. And I have to admit, it was kind of cool in two different ways, because I kind of felt like that line from Journey, you know, where you get to fall in love again. It was the same thing. Like I got to experience Civilization with a fresh look at it again. But at the same time, I still wanted to go back and play Humankind. So that's my recommendation in the undercard, is to go play Humankind or Civ or both.
On the midcard, Scott's going to tell you why everybody should own Red Cathedral from Devir Games. And Pat's going to question the wisdom of 3D printing and what it's going to do to tabletop gaming.
So it's actually Devir, not Devir. Yeah. Okay. Wow. They're a international publisher. They're awesome. They make really, really good games. They have a brand new board game called Red Cathedral. And it came out maybe, I want to say maybe 2 months ago now. And it is, honestly, at this point in time, it may be one of the best games of the year for so many different reasons.
Wow.
There's so many things that triggered with me with this game that I wanted to talk about real briefly. I've talked in some other things that I do about the shipping and logistics crisis that is happening in the world today and how it's affecting the board game industry. And one of the things that I have looked into the crystal ball and I have seen coming down the road, in my own opinion, is that I think publishers are going to have to get tighter with their boxes. I think they're going to have to look at things and stop shipping Lay's potato chips and bags of air. And they're going to have to really look at, how can I condense this box, make it still a good, fun experience of playing the game, while also delivering a good game without making it out of whack? And what I mean by that is,
okay,
in the board game industry, there is a perception of value to the size of the box. If I were to hand you a tuck box of cards that's the size of like a poker deck and tell you it's a $50 product, you're going to laugh me out of the room. But at the same time, those
cards better be really special.
They better be gold foiled with like dollar bills in them or something. But if I were to give you a box that is, say, 12 inches by 12 inches by 2 inches deep, and I told you that it was $15, you'd be like, oh, is that really a good game? Like, is that like, yeah. There's questions about things like that. Red Cathedral comes in a box that is just slightly larger than Munchkin, if you're familiar with Steve Jackson's Munchkin.
Yeah, it's about like, it's about five by seven.
Yeah, it's about a five by seven box. And it packs so much into this box physically. There are wooden resources for bricks, for wood, for stone. There's little plastic gems for like jades and topazes, or what's purple? Amethyst.
Yeah.
And they are, I should know that. That's my birthstone. I know it's what happens when you run a podcast. There's so much componentry inside this box, but there's also a great game inside this box. There is a rondel mechanism, which, if you're unfamiliar with the rondel in board games, it is a circle or a series of circles, and something is moving around them, kind of like a wheel spinning. And you have to make strategic decisions as to where to put things or when to use things on that rondel, because as you use them, they're then going to shift. The way Red Cathedral does it is, each section of the rondel provides you different resources, and you're going to pick a die and move it around the rondel a certain number of spaces equal to the face of the die, and then you're going to get resources based on where it lands. So that in itself could be a game. But then on top of it, it's got this amazing setup piece where the cathedral itself is different every time you play the game, and based on the number of players in the game. There's always going to be four columns of cards that represent the different sections of the cathedral and what you're building, because the basic idea of the game is that you're getting resources from using the rondel mechanic. You're then using those resources to claim and build sections of the cathedral. And then once someone has built six sections, that's going to trigger the end game and you're going to score victory points. A big shocker. I know this is going to blow everybody away. The person with the most victory points wins the game. I know it's never been done before. It's amazing. It's unbelievable.
How innovative.
But for the price of this game, for the value of this game, for the ease of learning the game and the complex strategies that are in this game, man, this thing hit like across the board for me. I absolutely loved it. And I'm telling you unequivocally, if I were to have to recommend a board game to you, it would be Red Cathedral right now. And I didn't 3D print any of it.
So we talked about piracy in a previous episode, where we talked about the idea of like, does streaming impact piracy? And it got me thinking about the impact of 3D printing on board games. You know, you and I both lived through music in the 90s when
Napster
lost their brains.
Napster.
Well, the thing they lost their minds about was they were like, well, we don't know how to make money anymore. Sure. And you've got three or four groups that were ahead of the curve in Metallica and Fish, where they were like, well, what we're going to do is we're going to tape every single show that we perform and we're going to put it online for people to download. And it's a thing. It's called Nugs, and they have shows that you can download. I have Fish's subscription. I can listen to any show since 2004 and a bunch of older shows, you know, and it's like Netflix for, you know, dirty hippies, I guess. But you know, Metallica does the same thing. And what they did is they figured out, okay, we have to figure out a new way to make money, because radio play and the traditions that we're used to aren't going to be the way it works. And it looked like it was going to be iTunes was going to work forever. And then that didn't work. And streaming became the thing, right? And so now everything is run by Spotify. So with board games, Spotify as an idea doesn't work really. I don't know that you can stream board games. Like, that would be a very odd experience. So the question becomes, how do you change up the business model to still make a compelling product? Do you make something that is about, you know, hey, we're making a high-end boutique item, or kind of, you know, kind of what you talked about with Ray Cathedral, where you hand somebody tremendous value for their money and it's just, it's great. Or do you just have a following that is built on the idea that we've got a, you know, we have a product, we have a company of two guys in a basement. Don't pirate our stuff, man. You know, don't get our stuff from China. Or do you embrace it and put the SDLs out there and write the rules? And that's what makes you special, is you're a rules company that gives your people a.
So I have a company that you need to look up, actually. Far Off Games made a game in, I want to say, this is off the top of my head, I want to say it's 2015. They made a game called Xia, X-I-A. And the full name was Xia Legends of the Drift, or Legends of a Drift. And it was a space combat game. And their entire thing was Kickstarter around the idea that you could help design the ships in the game, and they would set up a community for people to create STL files to then print their own ships, where they would do just what you said. They would, here's the rules for this ship, here's what it does, here's the STL file, go print it out and you've got it, right? Because this isn't a game where you had like 7,000 ships, right? Like, it wasn't like a, you know, crazy grand strategy thing. And it did well. I know a lot of people that still love Xia, and they've done a couple of other things as well, and have leaned into that piece of it as well. They have a brand new game called Aridia, A-R-Y-D-I-A, which did absolutely fabulous on Kickstarter. And it has some similar things to it, but it's high fantasy, not space. I don't think, you know, I own two 3D printers myself. I have two Ender 3 Pros. And I struggle to get things right on a regular basis. And I know a lot of people in the communities I do struggle to get things right. I've never delved into resin 3D printing, like miniatures or anything like that yet. But I think as someone in the industry, I don't think that there is enough people that could be pirating figures and costing people money outside of some things we've talked about with Games Workshop and some of the things going on with them. I think when you look at a regular board game company, like Games Workshop is a huge corporation. When you look at a regular board game company, not sure that there's enough people that would hit their bottom line to make it something they need to worry about yet, but it would be something kind of similar to our previous conversation. Leaning into it could really benefit you, right?
Yeah. And being aware of it and just not worrying about it. One of the tabletop case suppliers, the people who make, you know, the transport cases for Games Workshop stuff, their whole one of their biggest things is they're all about, like, here we've got a case for you, and it's all magnetized trays. So you put magnets on your minis, and that way they can't fall around. You're not putting them in foam, but they're not going to fall into anything because they're magnetized to it. And they have, you know, STL files for custom, like, layouts to their little magnetic trays that you can 3D print and make it easy to plop models in. Nice. So then you can build a display base and stuff like that. And they've leaned into it, and it's pretty popular. The companies that I've seen that go against it, it's the same deal with music companies. It's that weird, like, what the future, the it's out of the barn, man. You know, like I don't want to take money out of your pocket, but, like, that's because I have the sense of morals. There's a whole lot of people on the internet who just don't care. And,
well, the internet in general doesn't have morals. So
yeah, that's fair. But the idea is that, you know, embrace that that's out there. And if you're not going to make a, my conclusion is embrace it, that or make a boutique product that's really, really good. You know, make something that's special, like those, the Dark Knight game that, the Batman game that I think you kickstarted a couple of years ago that I drooled over every post that you posted of.
Oh yeah. From Monolith. Yeah.
From Monolith. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah. Too bad that game wasn't good.
Really? Oh, that sucks.
The game is, that's probably one of my biggest disappointments in backing Kickstarters ever, actually, but minis are beautiful at least. So.
Yeah. But yeah, it's something that the Games Workshop is yet to figure out, but other minis companies really have it. And their biggest struggle is dealing with China. And dealing with, you know, resin casts.
That's where you get the plastics. I mean, there's that, people constantly say, well, how come we aren't just printing in America now? And the answer is there's no one that's invested in plastics manufacturing on the scale that would support board game companies and being able to make what they need to make at an affordable price. If your game has plastic, it's more than likely coming from China. And nowadays, the high demand of crowdfunded projects to be overblown things and very hyped up on Pimp My Ride type things, that means plastic and it means a lot of minis. So it's interesting. All right. Well, enough talking. It is time for the main event.
I constantly have written about and always heard about the idea that wrestling is a soap opera and it's all about the story you tell in the ring, and the storytelling is important. But it's really, really hard to put your finger on what that means in any given wrestler in general. Whereas like you can watch a match and you immediately know what the story is. I'll give you an example. CM Punk against Daniel Garcia, it was all about CM Punk's leg and him taking his leg out to try and, you know, stretch him out and beat him. And then Punk countered that with, I'm a wily veteran who does wily veteran things, and outsmarted him, basically. And that was the story they told. It was simple, it was straightforward, and it was easy to follow and glom onto. Some of the best wrestling you've ever seen is that kind of simple storytelling, is that straightforward. Here's what's happening. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the good guy. Here's the bad guy. And this is how the match is going to play out. You know, in New York, Brian Danielson and Kenny Omega, their story was simple too. They're really, really good and they're going to beat the crud out of each other. And it's going to be who one-ups the other one. You know, and the thing is, there's a million matches where you see guys flip all over the place and do all kinds of crazy stuff. ECW would do this occasionally where they would just have a bunch of guys in the ring doing all kinds of crazy stuff. AAA and a lot of Lucha Libre is like this when they're not good. When they're good, it's they get it. But, you know, it's like, hey, I'm going to do a flip for flip's sake. Why? You know, that's where the term indie-rific comes from. You know, it's just like, hey, we're just doing a million flips because that pops the crowd. Yeah, but what benefit does it have to the story? Like the whole thing about like you should stop doing dives because they never accomplish anything. And suddenly, since Punk came on the roster, if you notice all the Tope Suicidas, which used to be every other match, you'd have like you could have a drinking game and be plastered from every time you'd hear Excalibur scream at Tope Suicida and whatever, but now they actually have impact and they have weight because to a degree they got shamed, and you know, it's because they stopped being meaningful to the story. And the reason storytelling is so important to wrestling is it's a dance and it's about conveying to the viewer why this competition is interesting. The World Series is about to start. I'm an Astros fan. I know what my story is in the World Series. It's we were good enough to win without cheating. See, watch. And we didn't cheat in the World Series, according to every account. But anyway, I'm not going to get into that. That'll flame us all to death. But the story is really simple. This is our redemption, right? And writers are going to write about that. They're going to write about Dusty Baker and stuff. as you look at wrestling, Hangman Page is this amazing story that's gone on forever. And as he comes into the final stretch of it, heading into full gear in 3 weeks, the story is about that redemption. Kenny's promo was fantastic. And they set the seeds for another story that you touched on in a couple of episodes back, with a simple moment between Kenny and Adam Cole, where he looked at him and went, he dropped the line about, you know, they won't be saying cowboy shit, they'll be saying coward shit. And then right as they're cutting away, he turns and looks at Adam. He's like, thanks for that. That was great. And the Bucks are like, oh, that wasn't you, that was him. And it's just, it's little stuff like that.
Keen eye, baby, keen eye.
Keen eye. And it clues you in on all this little stuff. Christian is a master of this.
Yes.
Where he does all of these cagey veteran things, like pushing on the guy's head when he's pinning him. And, you know, doing one or two things that are little and tiny, but they propel the story forward. The Rock was never a great technical guy. He was never a great flippy doo-dah kind of guy. He had all the charisma in the world. He had physical charisma for days, and he understood how to take the crowd on a journey.
He could tell a story.
Tell a story.
Yep.
And it's one of the reasons that he and Triple H were so good together when they feuded, is because Triple H could handle the technical end of it, and Rock kind of helped him blossom to a degree as a storyteller. And he gave him a palette to work against as a, you know, hey, he's the game and he's going to technically beat you up. And the Rock is a great victim for that. Some of the most fun I've seen in AEW is when Dustin Rhodes wrestles. I thought the match that he and Bryan Danielson had was fantastic.
It was better than it had any rights to be.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
I loved it. I really loved it. And it came back to the same thing that Dustin has done since he came back, which is, I'm an old man. I don't belong here. You're all a bunch of kids.
But I can hang.
But I refuse to quit, and I can hang. And you're going to have to kill me to put me down. And I swear, man, when he put him in that guillotine, when he released the guillotine, his whole face was blue.
Yeah.
I swear the whole time he was in the guillotine, he was trying not to breathe.
It's pretty amazing.
So that when he was released, he would sell it. And that's what storytelling is in wrestling. And storytelling begins with how you talk.
It does begin with how you talk. And that's my segment in the main event. There are
Segway.
Two moments, in my opinion, in wrestling that really solidified the superstars of their generations. And no, one of them is not Hulk Hogan with take your vitamins and say your prayers. The first one is Dusty Rhodes. Dusty Rhodes, obviously the father of Dustin Rhodes and Cody Rhodes.
Custy Rhodes.
Custy Rhodes, yeah. too much Ustin. So,
yeah.
Dusty Rhodes gave a promo that most people know as the Hard Times promo, when he was challenging Ric Flair for the World Heavyweight Championship in WCW. And it was a very opportune time to give the promo because of the societal things kind of going on in that day and age. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a little hard to find. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to paraphrase a short paragraph here of it. He said, he put hard times on Dusty Rhodes and his family. You don't know what hard times are, Daddy. Hard times are when the textile workers around this country are out of work. They got four or five kids and they can't pay their wages. They can't buy their food. Hard times are when the auto workers are out of work and they tell them to go home. And hard times are when a man has worked at a job for 30 years, and they give him a watch, they kick him in the butt and say, hey, a computer just took your place, Daddy. That's hard times. That's hard times. And Ric Flair, you put hard times on this country by taking Dusty Rhodes out. That's hard times. And it resonated so much with people who were watching wrestling at that time, because it's not a white collar thing. It's a blue collar fandom, right? It's the auto workers. It is the textile workers. It is the everyday person that was watching wrestling at that time. And most anyone, I think, who's a wrestling historian will tell you that was the moment when Dusty Rhodes gave that promo. That was his superstardom Dusty is going to be unbelievable for the rest of his career type moment. The
As
thing,
I like to say, that minted him.
It did, yes. And that same thing happened, almost ironically, didn't happen, but happened in 1996 at the King of the Ring, when the man who most people looked at and said is never going to get over because he's bald with black trunks and black boots, stunning Steve Austin, became Stone Cold Steve Austin, like truthfully became Stone Cold, with one of the shortest paragraph promos in wrestling, but easily the most important, I think, of that generation. And he was being interviewed by then Michael Hayes, who went by the name of Dox Hendrix. And Austin said, "The first thing I want to be done is to get that piece of crap out of my ring," talking about Jake Roberts, who he had just beaten to become the King of the Ring. He said, "Don't just get him out of my ring. Get him out of the WWF, because I prove, son, without a shadow of a doubt, you ain't got what it takes anymore. You sit there, you thump your Bible," parentheses, because that was Jake's thing, was he was a born-again Christian, and that was his angle at the time. He says, "You sit there and you thump your Bible and you say your prayers, and it didn't get you anywhere. You talk about your Psalms. You talk about John 3:16. Well, Austin 3:16 says, I just whipped your ass." And it was unheard of. It literally was the promo that not only minted Stone Cold, but it minted the entire Attitude Era. Yeah. It began probably one of the most successful, if not two most successful moments for the WWF, now WWE, to go on and just have Stone Cold rise to the top, become the leader, and have that next decade of him, Triple H, Rock, just so many amazing things, right?
Well, that Austin 3:16 t-shirt is still the best-selling t-shirt of all time, isn't it?
It doesn't surprise me one bit if it is. And I think we saw the same thing quite recently on Dynamite with Hangman Adam Page. And Pat's going to geek out, so I may have to mute his microphone on this one. Adam Page came back and gave his first big interview and said everything I would want someone in his situation to say. He talked about how he didn't believe in himself in the past. He talked about having to go home and leave his friends and leave everybody, and how he had the birth of his son, and how that was going to be, you know, this amazing moment in his life. And it was. And he used the line, and I don't have the text of this because we're living in a video age now and nobody like scripts it out or anything. But the rough motif of what he put together was that I feel like you believe in me. And for the first time in my life, I do too.
Yeah.
And that line was so well delivered and so spot on to the storyline that I got chills when he said it. Because if you followed his storyline of having friends, not being able to get to the top, being the jobber, the guy that Nick Jackson always refers to as the jobber, being the, you're kind of the bridesmaid, but never the bride, that kind of character. It was so good to not have this be a moment where Kenny Omega attacks him or the Elite comes out and interrupts him. It was his moment. They let him have the microphone. And more than anything, when we were talking earlier about Jungle Boy not being able to talk, this is the thing that separates the good wrestlers you remember from the great wrestlers that transcend the business. It was a moment where he stood out on his own, did not need anyone or anything else other than him. And he sat there and he said, "I'm not going to predict the future. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen at Full Gear. I'm just going to tell you I'm going to give it my all and I'm going to do some cowboy shit." Yeah. And it was so poignant and so good that I think in 10 years, 15 years, after the legacy of Hangman Adam Page has been written and probably will still be being written at that point, we're going to look back at this promo and that's going to be his moment, I think.
Yeah, and I think the second it's a wonderful bookend to before he went away, and when he came back, the whole intro music to the match that they lost, where he's with the Dark Order against the Super Elite, the whole thing of you don't need to be a hat to be a cowboy. You don't need to wear a hat to be a cowboy.
Yep.
Like, God, I was ready to go through walls when I saw that. It was so good.
That was a pay-per-view level entrance.
Oh, it was. It absolutely was. And that was great. And then he comes back and he expounds upon the idea of it, of being not just this guy who's got all these issues and he's grown them and I believe on it, but he got quietly intense and was just like, this is what I've been through. This is who I am. And this is where I'm going. And y'all have been with me this whole time. And this is how it's made me who I am. And he did the whole, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you what I told you. And he built up, you know, the hearing people say cowboy shit, and just, it kept building. And it was such a good promo. I might have had chills while you were recapping it. I'm going to be, I don't know if you follow Wrestle Talk, Ollie Davis, when CM Punk came back, he was crying. Like, I'm going to be so happy for that dude. Yeah. Because it just... Because
it's a story. I mean, yeah, it is a complete 3-year long story that is going to be an amazing payoff. I still think in the back, deepest, darkest corners of my mind, could Tony Khan pull a Swerve? And could Hangman get the title and then something go drastically wrong? Because that's Hangman. Things go bad. So we'll have to see. But it is a great story. It's a great story.
Why are you gonna do that to me? Why are you gonna hurt me like that?
We established at the beginning of this that I like the bad guys.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you saw the recaps, I didn't actually see it, but the Bound for Glory ending.
Yes. So
you had this great moment, Moose. And then Moose comes out and stamps on it. And
that was a very WWE ending to a pay-per-view.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You should have had the go home happy moment.
Yeah, and then Josh, especially with as big as Ethan Page has become in AEW, to see Josh Alexander get to the top and deservedly so, and then boom. Like, and not even that, beating Christian, who is I wouldn't say Christian is a legend in this sport, but I would say Christian is top tier in this sport. And to defeat him after he beat Kenny Omega for the Impact Championship.
Yeah.
To have your title reign last less than 3 minutes. Like, oh, that's so WWE of an ending.
It's not
a good story, in my opinion.
No, it's not. But now you have, like you said, the money's in the chase.
The money is in the chase, but I think that there is a point in time where you need to have a hero as the champion. You need to give people hope. You need to give people security. You need to give them the feeling of, this is my man, this is my leader, this is my woman, and this is who I want to follow, right? And, you know, I look at Hikaru Shida. Hikaru Shida was the longest reigning women's champion in AEW, deservedly so. She was amazing. And so she completely redefined that entire division at the head of it and did it as a face, and she was amazing.
She held it together when it was just with baling duct wire tape and hope.
Duct tape and baling wire. Yeah.
And crazy. She was also like, it's weird to say that the longest reigning champion was holding, was a placeholder, but she really was. She was there to keep the division from coming apart while Britt Baker found her feet.
And then found it she has.
Oh yeah. She is so good.
That's another story I'm looking forward to seeing goes.
I'm waiting for her to show up with the Elite. Like, they teased it the first time on Dynamite a couple weeks ago, and it's good stuff.
You never know.
But again, it's all this story, and those promos are really special. And I'll leave everybody with one of my favorite all time promos, and it's not one that elevated a guy. It unfortunately is one that destroyed him and ended him. And it's the infamous promo where The Rock was feuding with Badass Billy Gunn. And the name of this podcast was almost, it doesn't matter what the name is.
That's right.
I think Scott and I spent 3 straight days trying to come up with names. We come up with these really good names. We go find out, no, that's already taken. Okay, well, what are they? No, that's already taken. What about this? No, that's already taken.
It doesn't matter what the name of your podcast is.
And that's what we almost named it. But yeah, like from that moment on, Billy Gunn's push was dead.
Yeah, completely dead. Yeah, and one promo buried.
Yeah, and that's the thing is great promos can change everything. Can absolutely change everything. And you
that's have, why you gotta talk, Jungle Boy. Yeah, I'll help you. I'll be your manager. Just let me know.
Yeah, well, you gotta be able to run, you gotta be able to talk the talk. And
you have to be able to connect though too.
Yeah, you gotta be able to connect with the crowd. You gotta be able to connect, and it has to almost be an organic way.
And that's the thing, right? You look at the Hard Times promo, and it was Dusty as a blue collar worker connecting with the blue collar man.
Yeah.
And when you look at Austin, it was that point in time where the people who had grown up watching Hulk Hogan and Ultimate mm-hmm. Warrior and Tito Santana and Ricky Steamboat wanted something different, wanted something edgier. And having that kind of blasphemous moment of, I don't care what your Bible says or what your Psalm mm-hmm. says. Austin 3:16 says, I kicked your ass. Like everyone's like, oh my goodness, this is so controversial. Right. And so, but it ushered in an entire generation of new things.
And yeah. And it helped also that he had the best bad guy of all time.
For sure. Yeah.
He had the best, like for whatever I think of Vince McMahon in his, as he's aged as a creative idealist or creator, Mr. McMahon is probably the best bad guy wrestling's ever had.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to beat, right? It's a pretty hard thing to beat. You hear No Chance in Hell, talked about music earlier.
Yeah, there you go.
The minute you hear that, you know bad things are coming, right?
Yeah, just like when you hear, here comes the money. You exactly. want to change the channel. Yeah. unless he's been gone for a while, and then you're like, oh, cool, let me appreciate him for 10 minutes, and then remember... Oh yeah,
you're taking someone's spot.
Yeah, that's why I don't like you. All right,
we could talk about that all night long.
Yes, but we're not going to.
We've already talked long enough on this one.
Despite whatever Scott has done to edit this, and I promise you, he has edited this. He's probably pretty busy. This has been a lot of fun. The response to the first episode, we're taping this. The second episode drops on Friday, and we're taping this on Monday. I've had people reach out to me and tell me how much they enjoyed it, how much they enjoyed the conversation between you and I. And it's a lot of fun. We're two guys who like to talk to one another about this stuff. And
yep.
we're glad that you're along the ride with us. You know, say hi on social media. Don't be shy about sharing us with your friends, neighbors, you know, whatever.
Or your friends' neighbors, or
your friends' neighbors. Yeah, anybody. You know, get your mom who doesn't care to listen to it on mute. It's fine.
That's
you know,
right. Whatever. That's right. No, yeah, we really do appreciate it. We've had a lot of good discussions, especially on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You can find us anywhere. Just search for Main Event Meeples. You'll find us. But we really do appreciate everybody taking the time to listen and comment and reply and give us ideas and suggestions and things like that. It's you know, this is a community, and that's the idea as well. It's Pat and I talking, and we want to have a good time talking. We want to hear your voices too. So thank you so much for coming along with us. And as I always say, be good and do good.
Thank you for wasting your time with us today.
This episode of Main Event Meeples was not brought to you in part by CM Punk Ice Cream Bars, delicious as they may be, or Twilight Imperium 4th Edition, The Pocket Game, if you could find anything like that. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for coming along this ride with us. You can follow us online by searching Main Event Meeples at Facebook or Instagram, or following us on Twitter at Main Event Meeple. But until we speak again, may all your moments be the main event.